Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. With me now is the Manhattan District Attorney, Cy Vance. We originally invited him to talk about his support of Governor Cuomo's all-crimes DNA bill. By coincidence, he arrives today being in the news for something else, the awkward position he's in having to investigate the police commissioner's son on rape allegations. We'll talk about both those things and more. DA Vance, we always appreciate your time. Thank you for coming in again.
Brian, thank you for inviting me. It's good to be here.
And we just talked while you were in the green room to the spokesman, the narrator, I should say, of the third Jihad film that has the police commissioner and a spokesman in hot water. Any comment on that situation?
Brian, I don't have any comment on that situation. I've heard both the mayor and the police commissioner express regret for the film, and I have nothing to add above that.
On DNA sampling, Governor Cuomo proposed in his State of the State address to take DNA from anyone convicted of any crime. Listeners, for those of you not familiar with this proposal, here it is.
I want to expand the DNA data bank, which has been a great technological revolution in the area of criminal justice. It helps prove guilt or prove innocence. It's helped with 2,700 convictions. It's helped with 27 exonerations of innocent people. Right now, the database is applied to 50% of all crimes. I propose we expand it to 100% of all crimes. Let's provide justice for all, and let's be the first state in the nation to do it. New York can lead the way once again.
So, D.A. Vance, you're supporting this now, as you did when Governor Patterson proposed it in 2010. How come?
Brian, DNA is one of the most powerful tools we have, both in law enforcement and in the broader justice community, to both solve crimes, to exonerate the innocent, and to bring closure to victims of crimes and their families. It is a cost-effective tool. The governor's proposal would only apply to those people who've been convicted of offenses as opposed to simply arrestees.
And there are some, including some DAs in New York State, who would like to see it done on everybody who's arrested.
Yeah, and indeed, that there are individuals who support that. But I think it's important for the public to know that we're talking about people who've been convicted of offenses. And the expansion of DNA to the more than 400 crimes that are not now being captured for individuals who've been convicted of those offenses, I believe is going to absolutely save crimes, prevent future crimes, and therefore save lives, and is something that the governor is right to lead on, and I'm a strong supporter of it.
This, as the governor said in the clip, is already being done in about 50% of convictions. Do you have real-world examples of this helping to either catch or exonerate suspects in unsolved crimes?
Sure. I'd just start by saying the idea that we have such a powerful tool that we're only using in 50% of the cases that it's eligible for is a little bit like a doctor who has a powerful medicine, sometimes life-saving, but he's or she is only able to use it in half the patients that come in. That wouldn't make sense in medicine, and I don't think it makes sense in law enforcement. Let me give you two examples, one out of my office. An individual recently was sentenced named Curtis Tucker. He had committed a horrible attempted rape in 2004 of a young woman. DNA was left at the crime scene. After that, he went on to commit a series of misdemeanors in our courthouse for which he was not eligible to provide DNA. Therefore, we didn't know he was in our courthouse. In 2010, he was ultimately arrested and convicted for a burglary and an attempted assault of an elderly gentleman. DNA was taken upon conviction in that case. It then solved the 2004 case, and it's an example where had we had the DNA taken from this individual after the 2004 conviction for these non-eligible offenses, we would have solved the old case and prevented the future case.
How politically controversial do you think this is? It was proposed by the previous governor in 2010, and I guess it didn't pass the legislature or we wouldn't be talking about it today.
Well, first of all, I think people should understand that it has overwhelming support, I believe, across a wide range of people who are very concerned about social justice issues and criminal justice issues. Clearly, the overwhelming majority of law enforcement supports it for the reasons I've articulated. But crime victim advocates also support this. The city and state bars supported it in the last time it was before the Senate. There are obviously individuals who have been accused and exonerated, like Jeffrey Deskovich, who supports this. And so I think it has broad support. It has there are political issues with passing this legislation, but I believe that, as I think the governor does, that the benefits of this are so outweighed by the disadvantages. Frankly, I don't see the disadvantages, that we ought to move on this as a standalone item.
Let me read you a few criticisms of it that come from the ACLU's website. First, they say this would mean, if it's 100% testing of people convicted of crimes, even low-level misdemeanor offenses like shoplifting or adultery would require collection of a DNA sample. True enough?
True enough, but let's I think the facts prove actually how important capturing those offenses can be. When DNA was changed in 2006 in New York State to expand to cover certain misdemeanors, including petty larceny, there was this understandable concern that somehow it was inappropriate or it was going to be unfounded to take the DNA for low-level offenders. But what happened was, is since 2006, the DNA collected from those convicted of petty larceny have been linked to 965 other crimes in New York State, including 51 murders. And so what we see, Brian, is that individuals who commit violent offenses are not limited to committing violent offenses. They also go on to commit nonviolent minor offenses. And we are going to be able, by capturing the DNA from those minor offenses, to solve unsolved crimes, prevent future crimes, provide justice to crime victims. And we do so, by the way, in a very rigorous environment. We have there is no known instance in New York State where the DNA has been mishandled and the identification has been mismatched by DNA.
Has it happened elsewhere?
I understand that there are issues that it's happened in other states, but our Forensic Science Commission in New York State is very strong, very rigorous. It has a subcommittee on which people like Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld sit from the Innocence Project. There are criminal penalties associated with violating the protocols of handling DNA. It is overseen by 8 state-of-the-art labs in New York State. The DNA is tested by looking at 15 loci, not identified to a name. It doesn't reveal someone's genetic disposition. It is really focused on an identification match, and it's had powerful positive results to all communities across the state.
You talk about genetic links. One of the other ACLU questions is, it says another primary concern for civil libertarians is familial searching, or guilt by birth, as we've called it in the past, says the ACLU. Familial searching allows law enforcement to investigate family members of an individual whose DNA is already in the database. In these instances, only a near match is used, making all blood relatives of the person in the DNA database potential criminal suspects.
First of all, we obviously – DNA is an investigative tool. It's not proof positive of anything. When you find – like a fingerprint, if you find DNA at a crime scene or a fingerprint at a crime scene, it doesn't – it may not be proof positive, although it can be. So DNA is an investigative tool, is obviously useful, but in the hands of competent, careful investigators, it's going to be used appropriately and leads followed not to a results-oriented state, but where the facts follow.
It's interesting that you bring that up in that way, because the one final ACLU criticism of this that I was going to throw at you is this from their site. It says, an expanded DNA database could actually have the opposite of its intended purpose and make the state less safe, pointing to the British Journal of Criminology study of that country's ever-expanding DNA database, quote, insufficiently forensically aware police officers may resort to DNA evidence in lieu of proper detective work. Literature on case construction informs analysis of potential pitfalls of early reliance on DNA results, which may increase the risk of tunnel vision in criminal investigation, a phenomenon recognized as a cause of wrongful convictions. In other words, they're saying police can get lazy because they think DNA tells you everything, and then they don't do thorough investigations.
Well, it is incumbent upon prosecutors and police officers to train rigorously to avoid tunnel vision. and to not necessarily use the easiest fact in front of them to drive all the investigative aspects afterward. But I disagree with the proposition. I think frankly, it's unassailable that enhancing access to DNA has made us safer in New York State. I just don't think you can argue that. And the Symbol case from my office, I think, reveals that. But it's not a substitute and will never be a substitute for ethical, rigorous police work and prosecution.
Manhattan DA Cy Vance, my guest on WNYC. On Greg Kelly, the police commissioner's son, the Fox 5 Good Day New York host, he's been accused of rape by a woman he reportedly had a one-time encounter with. I'm sure you've seen the cover of today's New York Post, big picture of the commissioner and his son. But the headline is, DA smells a rat. Rape claim versus Kelly's son, quote, reeks of BS. Is that your position?
Brian, I don't comment on ongoing investigations. And I have absolutely no idea what the source of that incendiary quote is. And nor would I support an anonymous quote like that. I think the important thing to remember is our office has a very professional sex crimes unit run by very experienced people. Martha Bashford currently is the head of our sex crimes unit. We follow the facts in every case, wherever they lead, with an eye towards the truth. And but as to the specifics of this case or any other case under investigation, I simply can't comment.
You seem to have denounced the leakers. Prosecutors do this all the time, right? Leak information about their side of a case they're supposed to be silent about while the investigation is going on. So the press starts talking up their side. Is it ever a legitimate tactic, in your opinion?
Well, I think that it is inappropriate to leak in a criminal investigation. That's my position. And I'm not and I would not indicate or would not be able to state where that where that quote comes from. Or
you're going to seek them out?
Would be inappropriate for anyone in law enforcement to make that statement. If it was made, unfortunate.
Inside the article, quoting the sources, it says sources said the controversy I was reading the wrong section of that. Well, it quotes sources as saying two of the reasons that prosecutors are suspicious of the case are that the woman kept in contact with Greg Kelly via text and email for some period of time after that, and that she waited from October until just recently to report the case. I know you can't talk about the ongoing investigation as a particular investigation. As a matter of practice, would those things cast doubt on a rape allegation?
Brian, I'm not going to comment on that question, as well-intentioned as it is. I think it's just fair to say that our office, like any responsible prosecutor's office, looks at all the facts and does not reach a determination until it believes it has all the facts.
I ask really because women's advocates complain all the time, and I imagine this conversation is going on in some circles after seeing these articles today, that in the real world, women are often too scared or traumatized to report a rape for the first few months, and they communicate with their attackers for a whole host of reasons. I don't know whether this allegation is true or false, but women's groups say this is the kind of systemic bias that is used to get out of, rape allegations.
Brian, I think it's safe to say that our office is absolutely committed to protecting victims of sexual violence, domestic violence, and family violence. And takes very seriously allegations made by any person in those cases, investigates them, tries very difficult cases when we believe the cases need to be brought to trial, and achieves significant results in many cases that we bring to trial. It is absolutely essential for, victims of sexual assault and violence to know that they can come forward, they should come forward, their allegations will be treated seriously. That doesn't predispose the outcome of a case, but that they are taken seriously.
D.A. Cy Vance from the Borough of Manhattan. One more topic. The NYPD recently changed its policy on stop and frisk and marijuana possession arrests. largely due, I think it's fair to say, to the reporting of one of my colleagues, WNYC News reporter Elsa Chang, who uncovered the practice of the police asking people to empty their pockets during a routine stop and then arresting them for having publicly displayed some marijuana. The police commissioner now acknowledges that that should not be done, should not have the police directly ask someone to commit a crime, then arrest them for committing it, which is the displaying of the pot. As DA, are you glad not to have to prosecute cases like that anymore?
Well, I think the police commissioner absolutely made the right call in making very clear to his officers that that which is not a crime held in the pocket shouldn't be made a crime by asking them to produce it out of the pocket. It's clearly he was right to the degree that it was being done previously. It was important to correct it. You know, our job as DAs is we can't be on the street where police officers have these exchanges with the citizens and residents. But our job is to, as we screen these cases, make sure that when evidence is recovered in cases that are brought to our office when people are charged, that we make sure that the stops and searches and seizures are constitutional. From our perspective, the ends don't justify the means, and our job is to review cases where evidence is seized to make sure that it was done appropriately.
Can you give me an estimate of how many such cases you got for trial or plea before the policy changed and how different that pace is now?
I think
marijuana related to stop and frisk?
I can't. It's a real, you know, the memo was within the last several months. So I cannot give you, Brian, although I'd be happy to go back and try and find out what the change in numbers are. I clearly think there's going to be a change in numbers. And the number of marijuana arrests that we deal with is a relatively high number. So I think we will see some impact, but I can't tell you right here.
In general, do you ever feel like stop and frisk hampers you from prosecuting more serious crime as well as you might? Not that some serious crimes aren't uncovered that way, but because you're overloaded with petty cases?
Petty cases is a phrase, your term. It's not petty to the individual who's arrested. It's not petty often to the victim of a misdemeanor assault case. So I think misdemeanor court is one of the most important courts we have in our criminal court system. Of the 100,000 cases that we have coming through our office each year.
And I wouldn't ever characterize assault as petty. So I'm talking about nonviolent, drug possession kind of thing that turns up.
The reality is that we are going to continue to have in our courthouse and courthouses around the state a large number of low-level offender arrests. That's a reality. The question is, how are we going to do a better job with those cases when they come in? In two ways. One, we've created a special part in Manhattan called the Quality of Life part, where we now push these cases with low-level offenders so they can be cases can be heard by one judge. We often reduce the charges so they can be kept in a judge in the judge's court, and we hopefully get better outcomes for youthful offenders along with things like the Harlem Youth Court. It also has the byproduct of by taking those more minor cases out of the regular criminal court flow, it reduces the number of cases in criminal court, which helps us to do a better job on the more serious misdemeanors like assaults and domestic violence cases.
By the way, I'm just seeing a note from my producer who says she's just seeing a note from Paul Brown to the press. He's the NYPD spokesman, in which he's telling us that Kelly's son questions should be directed to Vance's office. That can't make you happy.
Well, I think it's appropriate for Mr. Brown to direct them to our office, and it's equally appropriate for me as the district attorney to say that we don't comment on investigations.
Fair enough. When do you think you would have a result on that, whether to prosecute or not?
I wouldn't predict, Brian.
Manhattan DA Cy Vance, thank you so much for giving us so much time today.
Good to see you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, the rise of three-generation households in the Great Recession, so-called accordion families. Stay with us.